Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So we're getting a little bit of a late start here, obviously. Not sure what's going on. I tried to use the other camera, and the wouldn't read the memory card. So I don't know if there's something wrong with the camera or if the memory card's bad. So hopefully it's the memory card, because that's cheaper than the camera.
Couldn't be full, could it?
I don't think it's full. I cleaned a bunch of stuff off of it, and there's only one video on it. So anyway, we're getting a late start here. It's 10 after 9, and you have your should have in front of you Lesson 106, William the Translator. And I've subtitled this Tyndale as a rough draft for the King James. So we're going to just kind of get as far as we can, all right? I have to be honest at the outset about a couple things. Naylene, would you mind getting the door for me so we're not distracted by the hallway noises there? Couple things I want to say. I've read a ton of material in the last 6 weeks to 8 weeks, month and a half to 2 months, on William Tyndale, all right? A book that I got just recently is this book right here called The Making of the English Bible by Gerald Hammond. This was published in 1982. I came across it kind of late in the game, and I wish that had it earlier because there's a lot of good things in it that I would have liked to include. So this lesson this week and the lesson that I've got planned for next week are about the actual translation of William Tyndale, his actual translation work, what he accomplished, and why it was significant. The previous two studies that we've done have been about sort of his life, the history of his life, the historical context and circumstances of his life in which he did his translation work. And so that was my primary focus for those two studies. So as we think about this study and then the next one, I could have organized these two studies a lot of different ways, and I'm not convinced that the way I chose to do it is the best way to do it. And what I might do is, after we've taught this, hope maybe even reorganize the notes a little bit and put and kind of move around where I put things. But we're going to have to go with what I've got at this point, and hopefully it'll still end up making sense in the end. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm sort of a little bit, I'm not sure I made the right choices here, but, you know, even if I probably could have gotten away with not even saying that, and you probably wouldn't have even known the difference, but I'm just saying that I have a little bit of uneasiness myself here about that, okay? So let's get into the introduction. Introduction. The previous two lessons, that'll be 104 and 105, considered a detailed study, a detailed study of the life and times of William Tyndale. Understanding the historical context in which he labored to give us the Bible in English is paramount in terms of appreciating its full impact and importance. Tyndale's Bible not only changed English society, but it established modern English and served as a rough draft for the King James Bible. Okay? So it's an extremely important thing, not only in the history of the English Reformation, but in the history of the English language, and then later the establishment of the King James Bible. In this lesson, we want to focus our attention on Tyndale's work as a translator in an attempt to ascertain the enduring impact of his Bible upon the English language, and subsequent 16th and 17th century English translations. In order to accomplish this task, I have elected to utilize the scholarly work of Dr. David Daniel and Dr. David Norton. The late Dr. Daniel, he lived from 1929 to 2016, the late Dr. Daniel is arguably the foremost scholar on the life and writings of William Tyndale from the late 20th and early 21st centuries. On behalf of Yale University Press, Dr. Daniel edited and published the texts of Tyndale's 1534 Revised New Testament, he did that in 1989, as well as Tyndale's Old Testament from 1982. Now I have both of those with me, okay? This is the work that David Daniel did on the New Testament, okay? This is the paperback one. I wish I had the hardback. I looked online at Amazon this week and they want like $900 for the hardback edition, right? But he edits this for Yale University Press. This is the 1534 New Testament. He does this in 1989. And what he does is he's providing a modern spelling edition, right? So he's gone through here and he's edited the text an updated the spelling of the word so that you and I can read it with ease, right? I have a 1526 New Testament, and you can look at it and you can read it, but it's hard to read because it's got all the old spellings and that kind of a thing. So David Daniel, he did this one for Yale University Press in 1989 for the New Testament, and then in 1992 he did this one for the Old Testament, Tyndale's Old Testament, where he did the same thing. He goes through here and he updates the spelling and so forth so that the modern reader can have access to it. So he's not changing the translation. All he's doing is updating the spelling. Okay? Now I should go back to this one just for a minute. You can get the paperback of this one, the New Testament, the same one I have here in paperback, for something like $35 or $40 if you were interested in doing it. It's still fairly reasonable. The hardback one like this one is the one I want, but that one's like $900. So if any of you ever come across the New Testament in hardback at a garage sale or a secondhand shop or something like that, let me know, and I would definitely like to have it if we can find it. Okay, but anyway, back to my notes here. So he does both of those. Moreover, Daniel wrote the introduction to Hendrickson's facsimile reprint of the 1526 New Testament. So that's this one that I've been showing you for the last two lessons. Daniel wrote the preface or the introduction to this. He edited and did this one, and he also did the Old Testament, right? So there's no one in the last 75 years who knows more, in my opinion, about the work and translations of William Tyndale than the Yale University professor David Daniel, because of his extensive work here, not only for Yale University Press, but for Hendrickson, who put out the facsimile edition. And so the introduction to this is also written by David Daniel, okay? As well as penning William Tyndale a biography in 1994, in addition to his massive history of the English Bible titled The Bible in English, Its History and Influence. That book is about 1,700 pages long, okay? It is a massive work of history going through and talking about the history of the English Bible, okay? So I've chosen to use these resources to do these lessons because I find them to be the most extensive from probably the most illuminated mind on this topic of the last 75 years, okay? Meanwhile, Dr. David Norton is one of the foremost scholars in terms of the history of the King James text. His contribution, A Textual History of the King James Bible from 2005, so that's this book right here, A Textual History of the King James Bible from 2005. Again, if you want to buy this is out of print, and this is over $100 on Amazon right now. If you want to buy this, which I'm sure most of you are just waiting to go buy after church, okay? But that one, as well as his 2011 book, The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today, this collection of books, in my mind, is some of the most up-to-date information on the topics that we're talking about last 2 weeks and then heading into this study, okay? So let me finish that point. Meanwhile, Dr. David Norton is one of the foremost scholars in terms of the history of the King James text. His contribution in A Textual History of the King James Bible from 2005 and the King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today from 2011 are essential in terms of ascertaining an accurate understanding of this subject matter. Let me also add, I have corresponded with Dr. Norton. I have emails, email exchange with Dr. Norton on various aspects of the history of the text. He's a professor at a university in New Zealand, and he and I have talked off and on over the years about different things that and different points that he raises in his book. And he has been extremely gracious with me in sharing further information with me, digital copies of further information that is merely mentioned in the book. And I've gotten access to quite a bit of things through my correspondence with him. So that's been a real positive thing. Okay, so I say all that because I want you to get an understanding of where I'm getting the information from. I'm getting the information from what I perceive to be two leading authorities on this topic of the last 75 years. All right? Any questions about the introduction? Okay. William the Translator is the first point. David Daniel does an excellent job in terms of setting the stage for understanding the enduring impact of the King James Bible. the enduring impact of Tyndale's Bible. Okay? This is what he says, quote, "The Bible translations of William Tyndale in the 1520s and 1530s are the reason why reading the English New Testament, and thus in English-speaking churches, we do not say at Matthew 6:11 the following. We should be obliged for your attention in providing our nutritional needs and for so organizing distribution that our daily bread, that our daily intake of cereal filler be not in short supply." So why don't we go look at that? Go in your Bible quick to Matthew 6. Now, how many of you even know what verse he's referencing here? Yeah, okay. So look with me at Matthew 6, verse 11. And let's read that out of a King James. Okay, Matthew 6, verse 11, "Give us this day our daily bread." Short, simple, sweet, and to the point, right? Not this, we should be obliged for your attention in providing our nutritional needs and for so organizing distribution that our daily intake of cereal filler be not in short supply. Now, that might be the way, could you say it that way in English?
You could.
You could. All right, maybe, yeah, okay. But, so instead of saying it that way, Tyndale is responsible for, look at the next part of the quote, "but give us this day our daily bread." That's how Tyndale rendered it in English in 1526. Okay? Short, sweet, to the point. The first passage was written in the 1940s as a parody. So the thing about the intake of daily intake of cereal filler, that was written in the 1940s as a parody. Okay? It was supposed to be sort of tongue-in-cheek, right? But the point is that the language of civil servants in London just after the Second World War is both dated and dateable, whereas Tyndale's sentence in the Lord's Prayer is timeless. Anybody who knows English, even remotely, have they heard the phrase, "give us this day our daily bread"? Okay, now I'm not talking about the doctrinal content of that or anything. I'm talking about it as a translation, right? It's timeless. Everyone knows it. We've all heard it. We know immediately what it's talking about when we hear it. Okay? At least we do. Maybe not everyone in the culture does, but many do. The simplicity of those seven words in Saxon vocabulary and syntax, matching the original Koine Greek, has continued since 1526 in almost all English Bible translations in the 20th century, made in their scores, with only occasional substitution of today for this day. Okay, so what that means, that the way Tyndale said it in the first printed English Bible out of the gate in 1526, has it endured the test of time with virtually zero revision of that statement? Yes. Okay? It is a timeless, recognizable statement that everybody can identify. So it is with hundreds of memorable phrases on English-speaking New Testament Christianity. Here are a few. "Blessed are the poor in spirit." You heard that?
Yeah.
"I am the good shepherd." "Fight the good fight of faith," and many, many more. So all of those phraseologies that we are familiar with as English-speaking Christians were set forth in English by who? By William Tyndale in 1526. They have endured the test of time. They had made their way into the King James Bible. They made their way literally all around the planet through the age of British imperialism, where the sun never set on the British Empire, and they impacted millions upon millions of people, some of these timeless statements made first by William Tyndale in 1526. Okay? Daniel explains how Tyndale was uniquely equipped to produce a translation that would transcend time in its ability to communicate the truth of God's Word in English to people centuries later. He says, quote, "Tyndale's gift, not only to English-speaking Christianity, but to language and literature, secular as well as religious, came from a unique ability as a translator. He had the technical skills of fluent and accurate Greek, Hebrew, Latin, and German, and other languages, and the machinery of recent dictionaries and grammars. He had a complete understanding of the complex art of rhetoric. His twin achievements as a translator, still admired, were accuracy and clarity, the latter allowing him variety of expression. Feeling himself free not to use the same English word every time the same word in Hebrew or Greek, okay? And then he's got a statement here I'm not sure I agree with, a method labeled in the late 20th century formal correspondence. He made his own meaning-for-meaning translations, lately labeled dynamic equivalents, and then I have it in brackets there. I'm not convinced that Daniel is using these concepts accurately, at least in that point. Tyndale's simplicity, for example, in narrative, where he was also superb, as in the Passion narratives in all the Gospels, comes also from a carefully judged flexibility. So there's two things to take from that, okay? Number one, is Tyndale very open to using a variety of English words to communicate the truth of the underlying text? Okay? So for example, when he encounters the word ekklesia, now he does not, I should add, in this case, render it church, because he thinks that's too Catholic. Okay? So he will render it assembly or congregation or something like that in his translations. Sometimes later on with the King James Bible, they do translate ecclesia as church, right? But there's a reason why Tyndale does that. Is Tyndale locking horns with the Roman Catholic Church in a period of history where he does not want to be perceived, he doesn't want it to be perceived as being what? Roman Catholic, right? So he doesn't do that. But my point is, he is open to taking a variety of English words and using a variety of English words for stating the truth of the underlying text, and he's not locking himself in to using the same word in English every time for the same Hebrew or Greek word. Does that make sense? Okay. So because he does that, not only is he able to create a variety, and so forth, but he is also able to really communicate not only in the issue, but in the two issues, therefore, of clarity and accuracy. So, any questions about that? So, the next point is going to take us a while to get through, and it's the point of Tyndale as a rough draft for the King James Bible. Okay, this is an important point. In his book, The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today, Professor David Norton argues that the translational work of William Tyndale served as the rough draft for the King James Bible. Okay? He says, quote, "The King James Bible translators thought of themselves as revisers, not as creators of a new translation. In the preface, the translators to the readers, they say," this is a quote, "truly, good Christian reader, we never thought from the beginning that we should need to make a new translation, nor yet to make of a bad one a good one, but to make a good one better, or out of many good ones, one principal good one, not justly to be expected against, that have been our endeavor, that our mark." Okay? So what are they telling you? Are they like wiping the whole slate clean and starting over from scratch? No. Or are they using what had already been put in front of them in English as a starting point for their work? Okay? Now, I'll even go a step further than that. Rule number one that was given to the translator said that they were to follow the bishop's Bible, unless the truth of the original determined otherwise, right? So the bishop's Bible was the one immediately preceding the King James Bible that had been done during the reign of Queen Elizabeth by some of the bishops of the Anglican Church at her request, okay? So they are not wiping the slate clean from the beginning. That's the King James translators. They perceive themselves of taking out of many good ones and using many good ones to set forth one principal one. One principal one. One principal one that everyone could accept in English as the standard. That is what they are attempting to do. That is what James has asked them to do. Now, we're going to get into all of that stuff later on, right? But understand that where we're at right now with Tyndall is sort of the rough draft of that process. Okay, so let's go back to the quote. The one good one that they were to make better was the official Bible of the Church of England, the Bishop's Bible from 1568. The many good ones were the testaments and Bibles made by William Tyndall and his successors. These men drafted and redrafted the King James Bible. Okay? So, William Tyndall, 1526, this edition right here, he sets it forth in a rough draft. Okay? He himself, in 1534, is he going to make certain revisions on what he originally said? How he originally stated it? I don't have it with me, but we could put another one here for 1535 where he made some further adjustments. Then from there, are other translators going to make further refinements to Tyndall's rough draft? Is everybody following what I'm saying? Okay, any questions about that before we move on? Okay. While he does not call Tyndall a rough draft of the King James Bible, Dr. Daniel presents the following statistical information that supports Dr. Norton's thesis. Quote, Tyndall clarified the English language. Since the early 18th century, the greatest praise has been heaped upon the language of the King James Bible, the authorized version made in 1611. Yet over four-fifths of the New Testament of that version is simply Tyndall's work from 80 years before. 83% of the King James authorized version, New Testament, is directly from Tyndall in 1534. That's what Daniel says. It has been estimated that 80 to 90% of the King James version is the direct expression of Tyndall. So we got three different guys there in that quote making the same type of claim, right? You've got Daniel twice, and you've got Briggs. So it's actually two different guys and three different statements. In 1611, one of the last years of Shakespeare's writing life, the English language was at a peak. It surprises nobody that the Bible from that time has immortal glory, yet it should surprise everyone. The work of Tyndall that was taken over in 1611 was done three generations before, when the English language was a poor thing indeed, almost dead at the bottom of the pond. Now remember, we've talked about that, right? The history of the English language. We did that in lesson 94, where I talked to you about the three periods, the Old English period, the Middle English period, and the Modern English period, right? And we talked about how English had fallen out of favor during the Middle English period and had been replaced by Anglo-French. We went over all that stuff, right? So when Tyndall's doing this work in 1526, he's doing it right at the beginning of when the English language is starting to begin a process of ascendancy as a language. Yet the King James Bible that is viewed as an immortal accomplishment of the English language is, depending on what statistic you want to use, there's three different ones, four-fifths, 83%, or 80 to 90%, Tyndall. Okay, so this King James Bible is four-fifths, somewhere between 80 and 90% Tyndall's revised translation of his New Testament from 1534. Okay, so when we think about the work of Tyndall, we should think about Tyndall's work as this and this as the rough draft of what? This. All right, anybody have any questions about that before we move on? That's a good question. I would kind of view it this way. It's not so much an issue in my mind after really extensively reading this stuff and spending a lot of time reading Tyndall's translations by reading these books here. To me, it's not really so much of an issue of Tyndall said things wrong. It's really more of an issue of the English language in a time period of improvement. Okay? So I think it's more an issue, not so much that the King James is correcting principal errors that Tyndale made. It's more a advancement in the language itself that happens in that roughly about 80 or 90 year time period. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's, I mean, there are some things in Tyndale that, you know, are, for everything good that he did, there are still some things that are a little bit awkward to read them the way that he said them, for all the, you know, high praise that we're heaping upon him here, and rightfully so. There are still some things that he said in ways that, you know, maybe are definitely improved upon by the way they're stated in the King James. But I think it's more of an issue of the language itself being refined and its usage being refined than it is necessarily that Tyndale said it wrong in his translations. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Anybody got a question about that?
Going back to that thing on the first page about give us this day our daily bread, that we should be obliged for your sins and blah, blah, blah. Where did that come from? That we should be obliged for your sins and blah, blah.
That's from a parody. Taken by, it says right underneath that, this passage, the one right above it, the one you just referred to, this passage was written in the 1940s as a parody, as the way somebody would say it in the language of the early 20th century. You follow that?
Yeah, kind of wordy.
Oh yeah, definitely wordy.
That's the way some pompous researchers
write
research papers.
That's exactly right. But Tyndale's goal, remember what Tyndale's goal was? Was Tyndale's goal to write the most flowery thing ever written in English? Or was his goal to put the Bible so that the plowboy could get it? You see the difference, right? Could he have probably been, and we'll see this as we go through the lesson, if we get to it today, could he have been more flowery and more sort of highfalutin and all of that? He absolutely could have been, right? He could have done things in more of a Latinate style, like the Latin Vulgate, right? And it would have been much more sort of, you know, sounding the way that you would expect academic people to speak, right? But that's not his point. His point is to put the Bible in English at a level that the plowboy can want, can get it, read it, and understand it. Remember that famous quote about, you know, if God spare my life ere these many years, I shall cause the plowboy to know more of the scriptures than thou dost, in exchange there with that Roman Catholic bishop. Okay? So, anything else there before we move on? In assessing Tyndale's impact on the English Bible, Dr. Norton states, without Tyndale, the English Bible would have been a different and in all likelihood lesser thing. Reading the King James Bible, we are for long stretches reading Tyndale. Sometimes little revised, sometimes substantially worked over. So Amy, I think that goes to your question to some degree, right? In my lesson next week, I have textual examples from the King James Bible of where they go on for 5, 6, 7 verses following Tyndale to the letter with only minor revision of what Tyndale had. So giving you sort of the documentary evidence of what I'm saying here, right? So let me read that one more time. Reading the King James Bible, we are for long stretches reading Tyndale, sometimes little revised, sometimes substantially worked over. A single spirit animates the Protestant, even to a significant extent, the Catholic English Bible, from Tyndale to the King James. And Tyndale was its first and most important manifestation. So it is really important to understand that the first guy to set the Bible text, the biblical text in English print, in a printed edition, did so in such an outstanding way. Okay? He's doing it in a way that is, for the standard of his time, it is absolutely astounding that he was able to say it and accomplish it the way he was at the time in which he was doing it, given a few factors. Number one, the state of the English language itself, and number two, the early stage. It is still very early. No one had ever, before Tyndale, taken anything in Hebrew and translated it into English. So he is pioneering that aspect of it as well when he does his work on the Old Testament. All right? In terms of his translation work in English, Tyndale truly was a pioneer. While manuscripts of Wycliffe's Lowell Bible were still extant, that means available, they were still extant and available for Tyndale to use, Dr. Norton presents the following reasons for why imitating Wycliffe was out of step with Tyndale's goals. Quote, "I had no man to counterfeit." This is Tyndale. Now, when he says counterfeit, he means imitate. Okay? "I had no man to counterfeit or imitate, neither was helped with English of any that had interpreted the same thing in the scriptures before time. He was indeed a pioneer, yet as this recognizes, there had been other translations of the Bible or parts of it into English. Most notable among these was the Wycliffe or Lollard Bible, which appears in two versions from 1382 and 1388. This pre-Reformation manuscript Bible, that means handwritten, right, manuscript Bible, was translated from the Vulgate, first with such literalness that it is like a crib for the Latin." Now, crib, when you see that, that is an English, that is a British word that means copy. The word crib there is a British word that means, we don't use that word really in America, right? We're talking about what you put a baby in. Maybe you've heard, that's still a British, I think, type of usage, right? But if you're going to crib someone's notes or whatever, like Sylvia says, what you're going to do is you're going to what? You're going to copy them, right? So his point here, Nort's point here, is that the Wycliffe Bible was basically a crib of the Latin Vulgate, meaning it's just basically copied word for word out of Latin into what? Into Middle English, okay? Then revised towards slightly more idiomatic English. What that means is, there's one Wycliffe version in 1382, and then it's revised in 1388 to make it a little bit more palatable. Now, we've already discussed that issue as well in an earlier lesson. Okay? Tyndale may have been familiar with this, but the Latin source, the very dated English, and the excessive literalness would have made it a model to avoid. So, here's what didn't happen. Tyndale didn't sit down with like manuscripts of Wycliffe here and just copy what Wycliffe said. That didn't happen. That's not what he did. He did not just copy the work of Wycliffe. He is going to go about doing this by himself from the original languages. Moreover, with the possible exception of Luther, Tyndale did not have very many non-English models to follow when conducting the work of translating. Therefore, Tyndale was very reliant upon original language texts. Tyndale's last surviving letter, written from prison while awaiting martyrdom, asks for, quote, "the Hebrew Bible, Hebrew grammar, and Hebrew dictionary, that I may pass the time in this study." So, what does he want to do? He knows he's going to die. How does he want to spend his time? Studying the Hebrew Old Testament, okay? Regarding this request, Dr. Norton writes, quote, "We should not take this as suggesting that he continued his translation in prison. He would have needed much more than that, paper not least. But it does show what he considered basic for this study: text, grammar, and dictionary." So if he's going to translate the Old Testament out of Hebrew, he's got to have at least three things, right? Number one, he's got to have the Hebrew text. Number two, he's going to have a Hebrew grammar that helps him understand the grammar of the Hebrew. And number three, he's going to probably need to have a Hebrew what? Dictionary that tells him what the words mean in Hebrew, so that he can adequately take them and put them into what? English. Okay? Tyndale's 1534 revision of his New Testament bears similar witness to Tyndale's reliance upon the Greek. The title itself reads, "Diligently corrected and compared with the Greek." Moreover, his preface, WT to the Reader, states the following. This is a quote now. He says, I have looked over it again, now at the last, with all diligence, and compared it unto the Greek, and have weeded out of it many faults, which lack of help at the beginning and oversight did so therein. If aught seemed changed or not altered agreeing with the Greek, let the finder of the fault consider the Hebrew phrase or manner of speech left in the Greek. In other words, what he put in English was his best attempt to render into English what it said where? In the Greek. And if there seemed to be an awkwardness there, it was a place, he's claiming, where the New Testament Greek was following the structure of the Old Testament what?
Hebrew.
Okay? Let me show you that. So in the reprint, that citation there is right here. The New Testament, diligently corrected and compared with Greek by William Tyndale and finished in the year of our Lord, A.D. 1534, in the month of November. And then that portion, the other quote is from this preface to the Reader right here, W.T. to the Reader. Okay? Any questions about that? Therefore, Professor Norton writes, quote, Tyndale's first study was the original language text, and his primary effort was to be as true to it as possible, including keeping to its phrase or manner of speech. In addition to original language texts, grammars, and dictionaries, Tyndale also had the following additional helps. Quote, for the New Testament, he had Erasmus's Greek text and Latin translation and the Vulgate. He appears also to have had a general knowledge of other translations, for he writes of all other translations that ever I heard of in what tongue soever it be. And he had Luther. Martin Luther, the giant among giants of the Reformation, published the first edition of his German New Testament in 1522. The Pentateuch followed in 1523, and Joshua to Song of Solomon in 1524. For the Old Testament, Tyndale had the Vulgate, the Septuagint, Luther, and possibly Pingentius. Okay? Estimates of Tyndale's dependence on these aids vary. Westcott and Hammond, that's the Hammond of this book right here. Okay? That's that guy. That's how I found out about this. Westcott and Hammond are most persuasive. Westcott demonstrates that both in his first translation and in his two subsequent revisions, 1534, 1535 of the New Testament, Tyndale dealt directly and principally with the Greek text. If he used the Vulgate or Erasmus or Luther, it was with the judgment of a scholar. Meaning, was he just following them verbatim?
No.
Okay? His Greek was proficient, but he probably needed more help with the Hebrew since he began to learn that language late, probably about 1526. While the truth of the original languages was Tyndale's scholarly priority, his motivation was to make the scriptures comprehensible to his fellow what? Countrymen. Now, here is the point that I don't want you to miss. Whose Greek text is he using? Erasmus. Is he using the Textus Receptus?
Yes.
Yes. Is he using or referencing Luther in German? What did Luther translate? The Textus Receptus. He translated the second edition of Erasmus, right? So the Tyndalean translation is a Textus Receptus-based text. It is the text of the Reformation. It's the text that drove the Protestant Reformation and its translation into English. It is not the modern critical text. It didn't even exist. Okay? Any questions? Now, I'm going slow here. We're not going to finish all this today. So we'll just get as far as we can reasonably before 10 o'clock, and then we'll kind of try to get the rest, try to repackage some of the rest with what I still want to talk about, okay? Dr. Norton chronicles how Tyndale's Bible literally touched off a linguistic and literary revolution. Quote, "The Bible in English shaped Protestant English-speaking culture. It was not just that the Bible was read, heard, and known. The Bible in English made the individualistic act of reading and understanding primary, creating a culture wedded to the belief that understood words were of the highest importance. Besides this, the Bible, more than any other writing in English, shaped the English language. This was an unlooked for consequence of Tyndale's work, for he never set out to create a linguistic or literary revolution. Yet this he made as the kind of English he should use. Did I mess that up? Yet this he made as to the kind of English he should use have an effect on every speaker and writer of English. Thomas More, his arch antagonist, mockingly suggested that all England must now go to school with Tyndale to learn English." Understand that he's saying that mockingly, but is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's absolutely true. His point was the difficulty of Tyndale's language. That we now find it remarkably straightforward and even powerful is precisely because all England went to school with Tyndale and learned English from him and his successors, most notably from the principal form his work took, the King James Bible. So, what literally shaped the English language?
Bible.
The Bible in English. Most notably and most principally early on, who?
Tyndale.
So when they're talking there about the whole country going to school with Tyndale to learn English, Thomas More does not mean, he hates even saying that, but he can't get around the fact that once this is in English, how are people learning English? By reading their Bible. Okay? Any questions about that? In his book, Dr. Norton highlights a point we discussed in Lesson 94 when I presented a brief history of the English language. Namely, that before Tyndale, English was not perceived as a suitable language for literature or scholarship, much less the Bible. In spite of the many English literary achievements we now recognize for times before Tyndale, English had no prestige as a language for literature or scholarship. To translate the Bible into English was both to debase it and put it into a language many felt had not the ability to express meaning. So again, that goes back to what I've said to you before, right? Was there a time period where they literally felt like you couldn't put the Bible in English because the English Bible had not the capacity to adequately express the intricacies of the biblical text? And here's Tyndale doing that, okay? Let me just see this next quote. I think we have time for probably one more, and then we'll have to see where we're at. Does anybody have any questions? Who's literally given us our language here? Tyndale. And it's literally being given to us by a Bible, by God's Word in English. Given his goal to provide the plowboy with a Bible he could read, while at the same time being accurate to the original languages, Tyndale elected to approximate the English he heard spoken around him in his Bible. This is fascinating, okay? So, is he doing this at a time where English is not really settled? So he has to make a choice, right? How's he gonna write? How's he gonna translate? Is he gonna translate, in sort of a highbrow sort of way? Or is he gonna translate in such a way that attempts to mimic what he hears, how he hears people talking all around him, right? So let's look at this lengthy quote. This is from Daniel, I'm pretty sure. No, this is still Norton. Okay. He says here, He had his duty to the text, and we have already seen that he tried to shape his style to its styles. He also had his duty to his audience. Images as the boy that driveth the plow, we would say the man in the street, it is a duty to be comprehensible to an unsophisticated audience, so that the unavoidable choice was to write in a way that approximated the English he heard spoken all around him. These two duties were paramount, and the choices seem inevitable. So he has to walk a line between accurately expressing the truths of the originals that he's translating, and doing it in an English, in a style of English that the plowboy, the people, the common guy in the street of his day could what? Understand. Okay? He probably had two other choices. One was to make the translation thoroughly literal, following the word order of the original and imitating its vocabulary whenever possible. This would sometimes have worked against the duty to be comprehensible. Another way to try to write appropriately majestic religious English, if only such a thing existed, but it did not, the nearest he might have come would have been to try to write majestically by shaping his language according to the best standards of eloquence he knew, those of the classical Latin and Greek. Again, the question of comprehensibility would have arisen, for the audience he had in mind did not know Latin. So what good would it be to follow a Latinate form of writing if the audience doesn't know it? That would totally defeat the purpose of him speaking to the plowboy, right? The common people would have heard much of what we take for granted as English as a foreign language, only partly assimilated into their own. And they would have found Latin sentence structures very alien to their own way of talking. Any attempt to write with the eloquence of the classics would have sinned against both the comprehensibility, and the English language just as much as a literal translation would have. There was a further political reason for avoiding a Latinate way of writing, either in vocabulary or sentence structure. It would seem too close to the language of the Vulgate and the Catholic Church, and so to be supporting the institution he opposed. So does he want to sound at all like a Latin scholar or a Romanish priest or a bishop or anything like that? That's exactly what he's trying to what? Avoid. Okay? Tyndale's choice was to attempt a balance between ordinary English and the ways of writing he found in the original languages. Fortunately, as he observed, the Hebrew, and to some extent the Greek way of writing, especially in its simple sentence structures and its vocabulary, tied to the very world, fitted well. I think we need to check that. I think that should say tied to the very word, fitted well with English. Tyndale stated the following in his Obedience of a Christian Man. St. Jerome also translated the Bible into his mother tongue. Why may not we also? They will say it cannot be translated into our tongue. It is so rude. Now, that's important. What's Tyndale telling you? Is Tyndale fully aware that what he's doing is going to be criticized by people for putting God's word into a rude tongue? He was fully aware of the times and the historical context in which he is doing the translation. But look at his response to this objection. He says at the end of page 5, it is not so rude as they are false liars. For the Greek tongue agreeth more with the English than with the Latin. And the properties of the Hebrew tongue agreeeth 1,000 times more with the English than with the Latin. The manner of speaking is both one, so that in 1,000 places thou needest not but to translate it into English word for word. When thou must seek a compass in the Latin, and yet shall have much work to translate it well favorably, so that it have the same grace and sweetness, sense and pure understanding, with it in the Latin as it hath in the Hebrew. A thousand parts better it be translated into English than into Latin. What's he saying? What's he saying? He's saying that English is better suited for translating Hebrew and Greek than Latin. Okay? Let's finish this quote. We'll stop. This perception of the qualities in English that match the Greek, and especially the Hebrew, is crucial to the way Tyndale translated. He could often translate word for word, that is, literally, and still write natural English that would reveal the full meaning of the original. It would be as true to the meaning of the Vulgate and truer to the way the originals were written. In this, in general terms, was to be the method, style, and purpose, ultimately, of the King James Bible. Okay? Now, for the sake of time, I want to leave you with a couple examples. Go in your notes quick to page 8. About halfway down page 8, there's a list of single words and idioms that we have in English because of Tyndale. So I just want to read that point, okay? Employing this translational strategy, so some of what we just went over, begat the following idioms and single word wonders into the English lexicon. Fight the good fight. My brother's keeper. The apple of his eye. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Sign of the times. In the cool of the day. Ye of little faith. A law unto themselves. Peacemaker. Long suffering, and then these individual words. Passover. Jehovah. Scapegoat, atonement, landlady, seashore, fisherman, stumbling block, taskmaster, two-edged, viper, zealous, and beautiful. Those are all terms that Tyndale is either going to coin or phrases that he puts into English because of his translational philosophy of trying to follow the original as close as he can and render it in an English that the common plowboy can what?
Understand.
And those statements there are just a few amongst others that are still enduring emblems of the translational work of Tyndale even into the 21st century. So, we're leaving off on page 6. I'm probably going to look at what I have to finish here. Look at what I want to do. I'm probably going to make some recalibrations to some notes and send a fresh set of notes for the next lesson. So if you want to read the rest of this, that's fine. I'm not sure how I'm going to sort of position things moving forward, but it'll certainly be worth your time, and it is stuff that we will cover in some fashion. Okay? Any questions? Apologize for getting started late, and I need to figure out what's going on here with some of our technology. So if there are no questions, I appreciate your attention. I hope you're finding this interesting. To me, this stuff is absolutely fascinating about where our English Bible came from and how we ended up with what we have. So, all right. See you next week.